I'm a desperate man. Send lawyers, guns and money. This shit has hit the fan.
Hi folks, Bob Main here with another episode of the Handgun World Show. The reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop, and this is episode number 90. This is going to be a very special episode because I have an excellent guest that's going to join me pretty quickly here on the show. I have Eric Shelton from the Handgun Podcast, and he and I got a chance to get together and just do some talking about guns. You heard me on his show last week. There's a part two, and the part two is going to air right now, pretty soon here, in about a minute or two, on this show, episode number 90. And we're going to talk about a whole bunch of things concerning sights and pistols and lights on guns and holsters and things like that. So you're going to enjoy that immensely. I want to point out real quickly an error that I made in my interview with Eric. When we get to the part about target distances in IDPA and USPSA, I made a little bit of a mistake. Typically, IDPA target distances are like, you know, 3 to 15 yards, and USPSA, I believe, has a 25-yard maximum. So I kind of messed that up a little bit, but you'll see the point. You'll understand what Eric and I were talking about. We were talking about the sight radius of a long slide pistol and how it helps at a longer target distance. But I think in the interview, I said something about USPSA targets being out to 35 yards. I don't think that's correct. I think I messed that up. I looked it up. 25 yards, I believe, is the maximum, and I think probably 20 yards is typically the maximum for IDPA distances. So forgive me on that, and the rest of the interview, we're going to talk about a lot of good stuff. So let me just cover a couple of announcements. Now, I'm not going to come back on after my interview with Eric. Whenever I do an interview like this, I like to just close it out with some music at the end. So let me knock out the announcements here near the beginning of the show. This website is handgunworld.com. That's where you can find my show on the web, handgunworld.com. I am on iTunes. For you iTunes users, do me a favor. Would you mind rating the show or writing a review? That would be really cool. Comments. There's lots of different ways you can comment on my show. You can comment directly at handgunworld.com. You can join me at the Gun Rights Radio Network forums. Just go to gunrightsradio.com and click the forums tab. This show is part of the Gun Rights Radio Network, and there's a lot of great podcasts on there, including Eric's Handgun Podcast. You can also send me a direct email, bob@handgunworld.com. I also have a YouTube channel, Handgun World Show on YouTube, and Handgun World Show on Facebook. Also, there's also a Twitter badge. Man, I'm telling you what, so many ways to get a hold of me. No reason why you can't. And I do check all that stuff the best way that I can. And so, that's it. Thanks for bearing with me on the announcements. Without going any further and wasting any more time, let me go ahead and bring on Eric Shelton from Handgun Podcast. So here's 15 seconds worth of music, a brief Gun Rights Radio Network commercial, and then we'll get started with the interview, Eric Shelton from the Handgun Podcast. So folks, this is Bob Main. Thanks for listening to episode number 90 of the Handgun World Show. And the reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. Don't go away. After the break, you'll have the interview. Here you go. Bye.
You can find this podcast and others at Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
All right, I broke a promise. Sorry, I said that I was going to turn the interview on right away, but I forgot to include this, and I have to put this in there. You guys know that I travel a lot, and I recently took a flight, and I want you to listen to the pilot's greeting. The pilot came on before the flight took off, and I want you to listen to it. I was able to capture it on my recorder. So here it is. And as soon as the pilot gets done speaking, the pilot from the flight that I took last week, as soon as he gets done talking, then I'll turn on the interview with Eric Shelton and myself. Here you go.
Good afternoon. This is your captain speaking with just a little flight information. Coming up on the left, we're going to be catching a glimpse of the Grand Canyon. On the right, you can be able to see the Hoover Dam in just a few minutes. We're flying at an altitude of 37,000 feet, and our airspeed is 400 miles an hour. Couple little facts here. I'm packing a Colt King Cobra. That's a 357 caliber firearm with a black rubber grip and a 6-inch barrel. Also, the co-pilot is carrying a Kimber custom defense pistol with all the bells and whistles you'd expect from a custom gun of that kind, with an alloy frame and bevel treatment on the entire gun. And our chief flight attendant, Roger, has a Ruger Bearcat 22 with a hand-fluted cylinder. All three are capable of piercing body armor at a distance of up to 27 feet, and it can put a hole in human bone and flesh the size of the Grand Canyon, which, by the way, is coming up on the left-hand side of the plane, so just sit back and relax and enjoy the rest of the flight.
Okay, folks, well, for the main topic of my show, I got a pretty cool special guest. I've got Eric Shelton from Handgun Podcast with me, and this has been something that I have been really hoping to do for a long time. I'm finally glad it came together. How you doing, Eric?
Not too bad. How are you?
Pretty good. For those of you that don't know about his show, you need to know about it. You need to listen to it. It's at handgunpodcast.com. Obviously, the name of his show is Handgun Podcasts. And Eric, you've been doing it what, like a little over 2 years, right?
Two and a quarter, whatever, some change. And started by complete accident.
Tell us about that.
Well, I was one of those gun owners who, like most gun owners, you know, always had a gun and, you know, a couple guns and thought, I should join the NRA, never really did. And I finally joined the NRA. Because I bought a Remington shotgun that came with a $10 discount, and when I bought it, it had a mail-in rebate for $25. And I thought, okay, well, that's the difference, so I'll go ahead and just join the NRA that way, because really it doesn't cost me anything.
Right.
So that's how I joined the NRA, and completely separate of that, I'm listening to the Gun Rights Advocates podcast put out by Mark Vanderberg.
Right.
You know, I just got my first iPod, and I'm driving for FedEx at the time, so I'm looking for something to pass the time. And every other week, he wanted a guest submission. So I thought, well, you know what, I'll just tell him about the fact that I finally joined the NRA and my thoughts and my, you know, journey as a gun owner. So I did one guest submission for him, kept listening to the podcast, and then a couple weeks later, he announces he wants to start a whole bunch more shows, the Gun Rights Radio Network. He's linking with a couple of other podcasts that I had started listening to, and they're going to get a couple more shows going, and they're looking for hosts. And one of them was the Handgun Podcast. And I thought, well, you know, I worked in a gun store. I'm pretty familiar with the different brands and makes and models of handguns. I think I could do that. You know, I got my concealed carry permit.
Yeah.
And I told him I think I could do, you know, like maybe a half hour show every other week. And before you know it, I recorded the show and it's terrible. You know, the first show is just rough because it's very odd to have a conversation by yourself. And I do this and I'm like, okay, well, you know what, fine. And I send it off to him. I upload it and I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 days later, I've got something more to say. So I record next week's show. And then next week's show. And I've just constantly got more to say. I keep running my jaw. And then everyone wants me to make the show longer and longer. And it's just kind of grown into what it is by complete accident. You know, I'm just hanging on to the leash, trying to keep up.
Well, it's a fantastic show, Eric. And I got to say that, you know, I did 50-something episodes before becoming part of the Gun Rights Radio Network, and I want to take this opportunity to thank you, because you started talking about my show on your show. That's how Mark and I were able to hook up, and I got to be part of this great network.
That's because you do a fantastic show, and I was really glad when a listener of mine pointed out that some other guy has a handgun show. I was like, really? You know, and I loved it from the very first episode.
Yeah, thank you. You know, funny thing is, you know, you were talking about having a conversation with yourself. Man, you know, if people go back and listen to like my first 10 episodes, they're going to feel that in when I'm talking, because I was bumbling around and kind of fumbling a little bit. And a couple of weeks ago, I went back and listened to episodes 1 through 5 of my show. And I went, oh man, I can't believe it. And it was because I was not used to talking to myself.
Yeah, I was going to say, you kind of cringe, don't you?
Yes, and and it's funny. I even had people email me after that. Hey, Bob, good show, good job. I like what you. And I'm thinking, really? You guys thought that was okay?
There are very gracious people out there. It's the only reason we're still doing this.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I want to ask you a question, Eric. You and I, as mentioned on your show recently when you had me on, you know, you and I like to carry a Glock 19.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you like that specific Glock?
I didn't at first. And I bought it on the advice of people older and wiser and much more experienced than I. I've got big mitts, I've got big fingers, and I prefer the Glock 17 every time. With the Glock 19, one of the things I've discovered when shooting competitively or running a course like the Mag 40, if I reload at speed, it is very easy for me to pinch the bottom of my right hand, get that meat underneath the grip of the gun and in between that lip on the magazine. And I've given myself some hellacious blood blisters.
With a Glock 19?
With a Glock 19.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you got some big paws there, pal.
Yeah, yeah. So what I like about the Glock 19, and the reason I still carry it, and I'm absolutely a disciple for that particular model, is Glocks work best in 9mm. And that 19 is small enough to conceal. It's still relatively slim. I think an average-sized guy, and I think I'm an average-sized guy. People tell me I'm a big dude, and I'm like, no, I'm really not. You know, I'm like, those guys over there, those are the big dudes.
Yeah.
But an average-sized guy can still conceal it very well. And but it's big enough that you can use it, for lack of a better term, as a fighting gun, as a full-sized gun. And what I've learned to do now is my reloads are Glock 17 magazines. That gives me a half-inch gap where I can't pinch the meat of my hand. I have never managed to, quote-unquote, over-insert the magazine. Some people say that that'll cause a jam. I've yet to have that happen.
I've never had that happen either.
Yeah, I've tried to make it happen. It doesn't happen. So I've got two more rounds, which, you know, whoop-de-doo, I'm already got 15. I'm not really all that worked up about that, but it's comfortable for me. It's larger, something easier for me to manipulate, and it just flat works every time.
Yeah, it does. Have you ever shot one of the tactical model Glocks, like the 34s or the 35s?
The long slides?
Yeah, long slides.
I have not. I'm not opposed to doing it, but I don't see that as being something that I would carry, and since that's my primary focus. Yeah. Can you slap a long slide on a standard frame?
Yes, you can.
Now, see, that might be something I would do just to goof around, because, you know, I'm a parts geek.
Yeah.
So ordering a long slide from, like, Lone Wolf or something could be in the future.
Well, the frame of a Glock 17 and a Glock 34 are exactly the same. It's the same frame.
Oh, okay.
The only thing different is the length of the slide, the length of the barrel, even the recoil spring and guide rod assembly is exactly the same.
Really? Even the recoil
spring? Even the recoil spring and guide rod assembly is exactly the same. The reason I asked you that question, I don't know about anybody else listening to this show, but I find I shoot the compact Glock better than I shoot any of the others.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I know there's extra sight radius with a Glock 34 and a Glock 17. And same thing with XDs or M&Ps. The longer ones give you the extra sight radius. Something about the balance of it.
I was going to say, it could be argued that there's more mass out front throwing off your balance.
I feel like it's front heavy, and I'm having to hold up the front sight and the front of the pistol more with those long slide Glocks.
Yeah, well, that would make sense. You know, unless you really felt like you just needed whatever feet per second, 10, 15 feet per second of advantage. Outside of the sight radius, I don't particularly see a reason to go with a long slide model.
Well, if you compete IDPA, USPSA, I have to admit, on those 25, 30, sometimes 35-yard shots, it is a plus.
Yeah, I could see that.
You know, so we're talking self-defense here. 30-yard shot? I don't think so.
No, no. For self-defense, not going to happen. Now, did you say 30 yards or 30 feet in IDPA?
30 yards, 25 to 30 yards. IDPA is typically 25 yards or less, most of the time 20, but there's some USPSA stages sometimes where the targets will be at 30 yards, maybe sometimes even 35.
Now, I will say I was kind of proud of myself today. I went shooting. I've got 4 days off from work, and one of the girls from work wanted to shoot a couple guns and see what she liked. So we're backing off, and at one point I just think, you know, I just wonder if I can do this. So I load up a single round into my Kimber SIS and can a Diet Coke at 50 feet. And I'm just saying, I was pretty happy I was able to make that shot.
But cool. Good shooting.
But 25, 30 yards, that's even further. And I just don't know if I feel like I could make a shot like that with a Glock. Not yet. That's beyond my physical capabilities right now.
It's not easy, but it does help to have that extra sight radius, I'd have to admit.
Yeah.
I got another question for you, Eric.
Sure.
I heard you mention on one of your shows a few weeks back, I think it was right after you went and took the Mag 40 class, that you got rid of the excess big dot sights and switched over to, I think, the Hilton Yam sights, right?
I did. I'm using 10.8 Performance, and I'm absolutely infatuated with them at the moment.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Because I really like the excess big dots. What is it you like about the 10.8s?
What I like about the 10.8s is, okay, I need to throw out a couple of different things here to adequately cover this.
Feel free.
I love the excess big dot sights. Okay, and I really don't want to take anything away from them. Mossberg and Remington both make great shotguns. Some simply work better for other people. Doesn't mean the other one sucks. Okay. Right. So the excess big dot, still a wonderful sight for my application. I discovered it didn't work quite as well because when we're getting back to those extended ranges, like we were just talking about, I was having a very difficult time estimating, my vertical alignment.
Okay.
The way I see it, you've got four different vertical holds on that excess sight. You've got the outer ring of the white. Then you've got the inner part, that tritium insert that you can rest in that shallow V. Then you've got a 6 o'clock hold. Then you've got covering your target, you know, your bullseye hold. And all of a sudden you're doing different angles, different covering of the target itself. And when you have the time and when you're practiced enough, they are absolutely accurate and they're wonderful. I've shot wonderful groups with the excess sight, but being on the move and being under pressure, I found that I didn't have enough time to calculate out a good hit. So these 10.8s, they're even, period. You know, it's three posts, you get it up there, and when you've got a level surface across the top, bam, you're on. And I found that worked better for me because I'm not necessarily a believer in night sights. I'm not a detractor in night sights, but I prefer to have a light mounted on any gun I own that's going to be used for defensive purposes. I believe a light is far more important than night sights. And a light with that XS gave me a very funny physical outline. You can't see the dots anymore when the light's on, but you can see your physical silhouette, and that physical silhouette gave me nothing to aim with vertically. The 10.8s do.
Okay, now you know what? That might be where you and I differ a little bit, but maybe you can talk me into it because I really respect your opinion. When it comes to night sights, I've made mention on my show before that I didn't think that night sights were all that big of a deal, but I do in fact prefer to have night sights. What are you going to do in extremely low light conditions with your 10.8s?
I'm going to turn my light on.
Okay, so you're carrying with a light. Yeah, you're right. See, I don't carry a light. Why do you think that carrying a light is more important than night sights?
Because night sights are definitely a step in the right direction, and I would never turn them down. Let me be real clear about that. I've shot in enough varying light conditions where I can see that that a good three dot night sight setup is definitely beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I prefer the light is because every now and then you can't identify your target even though you can make out your sights. It's simply too dark.
That's true.
And in situations like that, I have a Surefire that I carry on my person that I can use in my offhand or the weapon-mounted light. I'm a big believer in having the option. Some people go, oh, the weapon-mounted light, they're going to shoot right at you, and you should only carry over here. Yeah, well, I can do both.
Right. Well, you don't have to turn your light on.
Right. And the other thing is, with a weapon-mounted light, I have the ability to identify a target, to see what's going on, but I have a whole hand free to scoop up small children and get them out of the way, or close a door, or pull a barricade between me and the bad guy, or to be on the phone calling 911.
Like you should be.
Yeah.
All right, but let me ask you a question then. Don't you think that flipping on that weapon mount light, isn't that kind of a fine motor skill?
No more fine motor skill than pulling a trigger effectively.
Okay, good point.
You know, if you're going to have the center swirl or whirl of your fingerprint pressing back instead of pulling the trigger, matter of fact, I would say it's more gross than that. And if you need to, with a good two-hand grip, you just, you know, get your thumb from your offhand up there and flip the opposite side of the light depending on what your setup is.
So what light are you using on your Glock?
Right now I've got a TLR-1. I'm planning on dropping the cash on a Surefire X300 soon, mostly to test and see if it's actually worth the extra money. I'm very impressed with that TLR-1. It's a $100 light.
And so that's why you're using the Raven concealment holster, because they make them for lights.
They do. They make them for any light combination you want. If you want to own a Springfield XD and for whatever bizarre reason mount a Glock light to it, they'll mock it up and they will custom make a holster that will fit that combination.
So what's going to happen when you switch from your TLR to the Surefire? Are you going to have to get a new holster?
The Surefire will probably go on the Kimber SIS. I'm really starting to think I might carry that one. Okay. Because it won't hold quite as well in the Raven concealment. I'll give those guys a call and I'll have them mock me up another holster. The other thing is Blade Tech. I should mention that Blade Tech makes really good holsters and has a fairly decent gun and light combination available. So if you can't wait the 3 to 4 months that Raven is at now, mm-hmm. give Blade Tech a call. They make good stuff too.
But I've heard you say the Ravens are worth the wait.
I believe they are because I carry concealed. I'm not kicking doors in Afghanistan or doing anything crazy like that. Having said that, if you've got a training class coming up or you don't want to wait, go ahead and try the Blade Techs. They're a little bit thicker. They're probably a little bit tougher. Okay. They're probably not going to conceal quite as well. I've bought too many mass-made holsters that didn't conceal well enough that for me it's worth the extra money and the time to get a Raven.
You might be, you know, convincing me. I mean, you know, I've talked about the Warren Tactical sites that I really like. I like the black-on-black Warren Tacticals, and they're not quite the same setup as 10.8s, but...
Very similar. The only thing I've got in my 10.8 is I've got a brass bead up front.
Yeah. Okay, now why? Why a brass bead?
Because it was available.
Okay.
The tritium wasn't. If the tritium was, I am Madison Avenue's dream come true. And if you market something effectively, I'll buy it. So I would have bought the tritium. The brass bead was available. I got that just to give me something to remind me to focus on the front sight. In a target environment, you know, we're not talking, you know, self-defense. It becomes easy sometimes to start losing focus of the front sight. You know, it's one of those things that I constantly have to remind myself of. And that big bright piece of brass says, hey, look here, dummy. And I go, oh, yeah.
Very interesting. Well, you might be convincing me to dump all the night sights that I've got.
Well, like I say, it's not necessarily dumping. If there was tritium, I would have gone for that. And let me come back to saying the XS is good stuff.
Yeah, it is.
The only reason I don't care for it on my Glock is because, and again, I'm halfway through your revolver episode right now as we're recording this one.
My controversial revolver episode.
Indeed, sir. But you just got done saying that you thought the Glocks were hideously ugly and it took you a six-pack before you started thinking they look attractive.
That's right.
I'm a cheaper date than you. It only takes me about two or three. But what I like about that Glock slide from a pure utility standpoint is that thing is just one big flat arrow. And if I'm one-handed for whatever reason, you cock your hand 45 degrees, and, you know, we're not talking about the yo-yo-yo grip.
Right.
But 45 degrees, and I've got that corner of the slide that is working as a perfect, rapid, close enough is good enough at this distance type of target, much like the XS claim to speed.
Yeah.
You know, so if it's like, oh, my God, they're right there, that angle of the slide will tell me that I'm on.
You know, that's a good point. I didn't think about that, but that flat slide is actually a plus.
In that instance. Now, if I were carrying the Smith & Wesson Bodyguard or a 6.42 or a 4.42, which I'm planning on adding to my inventory here soon, the XS sights, absolutely. Absolutely. I can't think of another sight that I would rather have on a gun like that.
One of the Smith & Wesson guns actually comes standard with the XS, doesn't it?
I think it's the Bodyguard. And I think, what a wonderful setup. That is the way to go.
Yeah, I want to say it's 4.42, I think.
It could be. It could be a variant. You know, and it gets back to sights being such a personal thing. I can recommend the 10.8 sights all day long, but I can only recommend that you try them. You know, if you don't like them, then you shouldn't use them.
Yeah, that's a good point. Let me ask you one more thing before we wrap this up. What did you start shooting? What kind of gun?
Oh, man. That's kind of a trick question because I've come back to it and shot and then left and then come back to it. But when I really started carrying, I traded a lever action, like Rossi 92 or a 94, it was in 45 Colt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the ammo was hard enough to find and too expensive, and I just couldn't shoot it all the time. So I actually traded straight across for a Glock 31C. My first carry gun was a 357 SIG compensated.
Okay.
And, you know, it's
– I would never have thought of that.
No, it's a really, really bad idea. I didn't know what I was getting into.
That, you talk about a muzzle blast. Wow.
Oh, yeah. My God. I'd be shooting that thing, and my brother-in-law, two stalls over at the indoor range, would come over and be like, "What are you shooting?" You know, like, I don't know. I think there are grenades in these things. I moved away from that, not because of anything wrong with the caliber. Matter of fact, I'd like to get another 357 SIG here soon. I moved away from that strictly because of the compensator. Mm. And I started realizing that the way I carried, and in a practical defense aspect, there's a really good chance that I might have that gun right up on my person, be shooting from retention. And I like my eyebrows, and I want to keep them.
So what do you think about a Glock 32, which is the compact, same size as a Glock 19 in 357 SIG?
Probably not a bad idea. Probably a pretty good shooting little round. Again, because I'm a believer in always having a light on a defensive gun. That's actually my biggest reason why I won't own a Glock in 40. Now, the Generation 4s have probably fixed it, but a light on a older Generation 3 and older 40 caliber Glock causes failures to feed. And you might still see that problem with a 357 SIG. You might not, because the slide might be moving faster. So that would be one I would want to experiment with. But I would definitely consider it.
Okay, interesting. See, and the reason I asked you that question, Eric, is because I don't want people to think that I'm a Glock fanboy just because I talk about them so much. But I happen to know that you and I like the same type of a carry gun, which is a Glock 19. And, you know, for me, you've just explained why. But for me, I've tried so many others, and I just keep coming back to that one.
Well, part of the reason for a Glock for me is because it's a defensive gun. And if something happens to it, then I don't care, and I go get another one, and it's exactly the same as the last one. You know, it's not a 1911 that I have an emotional investment in. It's not a revolver that I have an emotional investment in. Speaking of which, there are two things that I want to throw at you real quick that I forgot to do when,
please do.
When we were talking on my show earlier.
Please do, yeah.
You mentioned that you heard me talking about the M&P for the 45, and I should be really specific that I want an M&P in 45. When it comes to a 9mm, I'm sticking with the Glock 19 come hell or high water, because in my opinion, nothing has really started to perform that much better yet. But I do believe that the M&P design in 45, I believe it works better than the Glock 45s.
You know, and I saw one at a gun shop recently. It was an M&P with a full-size grip, but it had a 4-inch barrel.
Oh, that's the one I want.
Yes, yes. A little pricey. The guy had it marked at $599, which I thought was a little high.
Ouch.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's a
you know,
high.
And the best deal I can get if I bat my eyes real pretty and talk about like a military discount or whatever, the best deal I can get apparently is 2 free magazines from Smith & Wesson.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But, you know, I'll take it, and it is what it is.
I've heard great things about those M&P 45s.
I have, and like I say, and that's really the caliber that interests me in that gun. Because I am a believer that certain platforms work better in certain calibers. The other thing is your revolver talk.
Yes. Okay.
What was it that was so controversial? Since we're on your show, just give me the feedback here.
Well, I was going to bring it up. You brought it up before I did, so that's okay. Someone on the forum, on the Gun Rights Radio Network forum, basically put a post on there, and he just posted it today. Basically, I'll paraphrase it. Basically, stating that I must not have a whole lot of experience with revolvers because of some of the comments I made, and the fact that when I reviewed them, I used a Ruger LCR, which is an extremely lightweight revolver, and then I used a Smith & Wesson 686. And he says, "Gosh, you know," he says, "you couldn't go from one extreme to the other." And that was kind of – it seems like that's kind of the whole premise of his post. I'll have to say this. First of all, he's correct. I don't have a lot of experience with revolvers. Maybe I took a chance with that episode. I've said many times I don't like to review guns that I haven't owned and put a lot of rounds through it. So maybe I took a chance, and maybe there were some things on there that were inaccurate. But I remember saying repeatedly in that show that – From a reliability standpoint, that probably a revolver is probably going to be more reliable than most semi-automatics.
Well, I remember specifically, because I actually remember the intersection I was driving through when you said, "This is just my opinion, and I could be wrong. If I am, let me know."
Exactly.
So as far as criticism goes, I would say not to worry about it too much.
Yeah.
Recently on my show, I said that I don't shoot primitive weapons. You know, and it's kind of a joke that I got from John Hottaway at the Mag 40 class. John's a great guy, wonderful instructor. But I didn't see this post because I don't venture out of the handgun podcast area and the forum very much. There's just too much to try and keep track of. When it comes to revolvers, my view is that they have become best served in a specialized role.
Sure.
Whether that's as a backup gun that's going to be more reliable, that can't be pressed out of battery, or whether that's shooting a higher power cartridge like a 357, a 44, handgun hunting for larger game.
Exactly.
There are certain roles that a revolver is better for. And in those roles, an autoloader simply cannot compete.
However, yeah, I agree. In fact, I even mentioned handgun hunting in my revolver podcast.
Yeah. However, they're also limited roles. And as an overall gun, as a daily carry gun, I find the autoloader to be much better. One of the things I wanted to hit, actually, I remember you mentioned females possibly having not enough strength to rack a slide.
Yes, yes.
I'm going to throw this out here. If she doesn't have enough strength to rack a slide, do you think she's got enough strength to pull a 12-pound trigger?
I knew you were going to say that, and the answer that I would give is probably not. And I realized that was a mistake I made in that show. If she can't rack the slide, she probably can't pull that heavy trigger. However, she could get a trigger job done on the revolver.
She could. I think it's more a matter of technique. I've been out shooting with a girl who, when she was getting ready to pull the trigger, she tried harder and harder and harder, and she's squeezing it. This is on a Ruger SP-101.
Mm-hmm.
And I start noticing that the bore starts tipping up and up and up, and she's getting ready to put a round right into the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just say, okay, we're done. We're done. That's good.
Yeah, that's it. Well,
when it comes to racking a slide,
yeah,
there's a technique. Have you ever taken any martial arts?
Very little.
That's all you need? Because I guarantee, even with very little, when you throw a punch, they say put your hips into it, right?
Exactly, yeah. I do remember.
Your whole body moves with it.
Right.
So what you can do then is with an autoloader. Now, it's the girl I went out shooting with today, I call her Flaca because she's a skinny little thing. And I gave her my Kimber SIS. Now, this has a heavier recoil spring in it. The hammer's down. I mean, and it's slippery. This is not an easy gun to rack the slide on. Mass IU
right.
noted that in his write-up. So I have her lock her arms. She's got one grip, one hand, her firing hand in a proper grip. Her left hand is over the gun. Both elbows are locked. And then she just rotates from her hips, from her shoulders, the whole nine yards, make it a full body thing. And she was able to yank that slide absolutely no problem.
Very good point. Yeah, and I missed that. I missed that in my show, and I admit that I missed that. So, you know, I'll stand corrected on that one. It's a good point.
If nothing else, if you go out shooting and someone's having trouble racking a slide, just remember that full body, almost like they're throwing a punch in martial arts. Lots of people will say go cross the body.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I don't like to do that is while it's a closing motion, one arm towards the other, and it is easier, you do get more muscle involved. I don't like sweeping the bore of the muzzle around.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Well, can I ask you one more thing since we're on a revolver topic?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
In that show, I guess one of the criticisms I got was when I was talking about the revolver reliability and so forth, and how sometimes things can obstruct the cylinder and obstruct the firing pin.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to go on record and say that the main point I was trying to make in that show was that, and tell me if you'd agree with this or if you'd disagree, oftentimes people will buy a small snubby revolver as their first gun.
Horrible idea.
But would you agree it happens a lot, though?
Yes. Yes, and more than that, unfortunately, I would say people recommend that as a first gun.
Exactly. A lot of gun store clerks will say, especially when they're talking to a female, they'll say, oh, this, you know, they'll hand her a snubby, lightweight, scandium frame revolver and say, here, this is what you need, and sometimes that's what they buy it. And even if it's a man and it's his first gun, first concealed carry gun, he buys that, he goes to the range with two boxes of ammo, and he shoots 100 rounds, and he goes, oh, God, what did I buy?
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
I just shot a 4.42 with full power 38-plus piece, you know, like 158 grains, five rounds of that, and I thought, wow, I'm glad that's something I don't do every day.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and that's not even a scandium.
Well, and I noticed that when I was doing the revolver show, and we and James and I rented that little Ruger LCR, the little polymer-framed Ruger.
Mm-hmm.
That was no fun to shoot.
I like my Ruger SP-101 because it's heavier. It eats up a lot of recoil. And throwing 38s through that, I can do it all day.
Yeah.
When it comes to the reliability, stuff getting in the channel and whatnot, that's one reason why I'm a big believer in having a fully shrouded hammer, like a Smith & Wesson 6.42, 4.42, the
Good
Ruger
point.
LCR, because I want something snag-free. I don't want a hammer at all on a defensive gun. Whether it's in a lady's purse or whether it's something I'm trying to clear out of concealed carry clothing, I want it to be snag-free. From there, I also want it to be double action only.
Right.
Never want the allegation of a hair trigger.
Yeah, exactly.
What you do have is you have the possibility of messing up your timing. And the timing is the gear in the cylinder that when you pull the trigger – causes your individual cylinder to actually lock up with the bore and be in the correct alignment. If it's not, you can wind up shaving the bullet as you start firing it downrange. That's generally considered a bad thing. And you know the Hollywood thing where they've got it open, they double check, and then they flip their wrist to lock it in there?
Yes.
Oh, God, I didn't know any better at one time, but I was made very, very much aware that that was a bad thing to do to a revolver, because at that point the crane doesn't support the cylinder well enough, and right. and you can actually damage the gun that way. Now once it's locked up, it's fine. But that would be the thing I would say. I would want the frame of the gun to cover any of the timing gears acceptably. And it should be in a holster. And I heard you specifically mention, I don't care if you're pocket carrying, you need to have that thing in a holster. And you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and a lot of people are told, get a snubby revolver because it's stone cold reliable. And by the way, you don't need a holster. Just throw it in your pocket or throw it in your coat pocket and go on your merry way. And I just think that's wrong, and that was kind of the whole point mainly of that podcast was I don't think it's a good beginner's gun, and I think people make a lot of mistakes sometimes buying that on the recommendation without actually checking it out.
Well, the Pro Arms crew at the Pro Arms podcast has actually called it an expert's gun.
Yeah, it is.
It is very accurate. It is wonderful, but you've got a very short sight radius, and you've got a heavy trigger pull.
I would think if someone wants a small gun to conceal, they might be better served with something like a Glock 20 or a Glock 26 or a Kar PM9 or something like that.
And in that instance, actually, that's where you and I are going to differ. I would prefer a 442 or a 642.
Oh, you would? Okay.
I would, because if I've gone to my backup gun, if I've gone to something that small, yeah. I'm just going to count on I need something, because I haven't gotten away fast enough. I need something that'll fire even if this guy's right on me.
Yeah, like if it's something that he can't push out of battery.
Exactly.
Good point. Thanks, Eric. I appreciate it. This has kind of run longer than I wanted to expect, but...
Yeah, I didn't know it was going to go so long. I got wordy, but it's been a lot of fun.
No, that's okay. You know what? This has been a great opportunity, and thanks for coming on my show, folks. His show is Handgun Podcast. That's at handgunpodcast.com. He's also on iTunes. Just a terrific show, and if you're not listening to Eric's show, listen to it. Thanks for coming on.
No, thanks for having me.
All right, take care.
This shit has hit the fan. Guns and money.